access number 11938, reel 41.
Mr. G. Iston, reel 41. What was the mood of the battalion when it came out of this particularly heavy attack at Alamein, Mr. Iston?
Tired. Definitely tired. We got back to Tel Alisa Station, or the area of Tel Alisa Station, just south of Tel Alisa, somewhere around 4 o'clock on the morning of the third. We were 36 hours from the attack going in to coming out, so that would make it the... Went in on the night of the first, didn't it, and the attack was on the second. So early hours of the fourth, when we got back to Tel Alisa Station. And we had a quick meal, and frankly, there was only one thing in, I think, everybody's minds at that particular time was, could they get some sleep? There had been no sleep for probably 5 days, because we had the move up out of the line, out of the Alamein line where we were, up to Tel Alisa Station, and then we had a hold up while other people got in position. So it was really 5 days without sleep. I suppose they were down the dumps a bit, we'd lost some men, but really speaking, if you think on old World War, World War One style, we'd lost nobody, in fact. I forget what it was now. I think there were only about 25 killed, actually, at the Battle of Alamein. That's the main battle on the 2nd of November. I'd just like to go back to that battle again, if I can, because Colonel Battiscombe's attack was a very similar affair. And the more I think about it, the more I think it was rehearsal for the battle that was to come. For all we were told, that we weren't going to be in the actual battle in the early stages. But the more I see and think about it, the more I realise that Colonel Battiscombe's attack was a preliminary for the attack itself, because we had to wait for the artillery getting into position. Colonel Battiscombe had to wait. It was going to be a silent attack to start with. And then there was a barrage, and then a creeping barrage, just like the Alamein attack itself, and it worked all the way through the Alamein battle. And I mean, the battle, I think, was really spread to about 9 days, Alamein. But prior to that, as I've said before, we'd been in, I think, every brigade in the 8th Army, and I should think that the line had been moved forward, especially in the north, because Tel Alisa Station was well in the enemy lines when the first time we went to Alamein, and I should think we'd gained something like 10 miles of land in the old World War One style of infantry charging forward with bayonets and taking trenches and pushing the enemy back. So really speaking, the line was very different on the 23rd of October than it was when we went back in the line the first time. Now, for the attack itself at Alamein, we had two battalions going forward west, just like Colonel Battiscombe did, but the 6th Battalion did the wheel round and completed the third side of the box, which didn't happen in Colonel Battiscombe's attack, and that's how the Germans came round in behind him in the finish, and we couldn't get the anti-tank guns through. This time the anti-tank guns went out with the 6th Battalion, more or less. As soon as they got their line facing north, the anti-tank guns were in position, and the anti-tank guns went out the 8th and 9th Battalion. So there's the defence round the box, not left open the way we were previously. Well, having got back to Tel Alisa, we did get a good meal. And as I said, the only thing that we really wanted was sleep.
Had you lost any of your older men that had been with you a long time?
Yes, we'd lost RSM Page, who was a great loss. The MO. I think all told we lost about 25, but they stick out in my memory because RSM Page and I, for all he was there. The RSM's a peculiar fella, really. is this disciplinarian of the battalion. He is the historian of the battalion. I suppose his real task in battle is to get ammunition forward, and he buries the dead. In fact, he's one of his responsibilities, burying the dead. He's in charge of the provost. They come more or less directly under him, who are responsible for the prisoners and the signing of whatever we're going in the dark. Generally, very often, RSM Page in particular was always connected with the concert party. He didn't have so much to do with the dance band, but the dance band was always connected with the concert party. So he was a great fellow, RSM Page. He could be, he could tear a strip off you, and the same night he'd have a drink with you. He was that type of man. He was, I can only say he was a great man. Strict, yes, that was his job, to be strict. I mean, he was the man who really set the cleanliness, if you like, and him and the adjutant between them. The the CO would go down the line and make some comments, but they were the people who had to implement them. The CO didn't... they were the people, the adjutant and the RSM, who really implemented anything that the CO wanted doing.
You had a new CO at this time.
Yes, Colonel Watson had an old stager with the battalion. He was now the CO, since Colonel Battlescombe was captured at, in the first attempt. I don't think it made so much difference, because I think anything that he had to do had been done before he became CO, in a sense. There might have been the odd things which we didn't know. But no, he was... I still think that Colonel Watson was trying to push his old B Company boys. For all B Company had been defunct now for some period, I think. Well, certainly since Matru, there'd been no B Company. And I think it more or less went after Gazala, after the escape from Gazala. We had no B Company now. But he was still pushing his old soldiers from Barnacastle, let's put it that way. And in pushing, he maybe appeared to be a bit niggly, because he was trying to get people to be right, and I won't say straight, he was trying to make good soldiers, especially a B Company. And I think a lot of it, me in particular, I think I took it maybe the wrong way, that he was trying to do me good, but I was a rebel and I didn't quite see it that way. But I don't think there was... he was a good soldier in his way. I liked him at the end of the end of the time. But I must say that there was times when he really got your dander up, and you couldn't remember your name you could think of. But that's the way it is. Just one little thing. Talaliza... Arabic is an Arabic name for the Hill of Jesus, and in fact Tel Eliza were two hubs on the Alamein coastline, that on the maps they were point 24 and point 25, they were point 24 east and 24 west, they're about a mile apart going towards El Darba. It's just the name, the Hill of Jesus. A lot of names all the way up the coast. You get city is very often the grave of some Mohammedan or something like that. But this is one that sort of just did intrigue me a little bit. It's on the station at Tel Eliza.
Where did you move to after you'd rested?
Well, we'd only been in Tel Eliza one night in the resting place. And we moved up to the 9th Australians again. They had a bad time, and there's some 88 guns giving them a bit of trouble. And then from there we went straight on to El Darba to protect a very big dump. There's a workshop and I think a divisional headquarters, or it could have been a corps headquarters. And there was a really big dump. And we were set up there to sort of protect this dump. And we set off marching up. And as we marched out of the Australian lines, or what had been the Australian lines, there was an 88 there, and it was right on the roadside, and was burnt out. It was a horrific sight, really, to see this tracked 88 completely burnt out. And then you stop and wonder how many got caught with these shells. Peculiar feeling to go past this, and there was German crew still on board, still hanging around it, just starting to smell the flies around the field here. And the shy dogs hadn't quite got that far yet, but because there was too many people milling around, I think, but you could tell that they wouldn't be long before they were down picking the bones clean. And we were off the road at this time, sort of either side of the road, mopping up as we went. We were sniped at a little bit, but not a great lot. But there were one or two snipers still hanging around that had to be picked up. And I don't know how far we marched, probably about 6 or 8 miles, I should think. And then the troops were drawn into the roadside, and transport came along. There was a full stream of transport now, and we seemed to have lost all our air raid precaution thing altogether. The trucks were coming nose to tail. The battalion came in close to the road and sort of close together. We must have been confident. That's all I can say, because we'd almost forgotten any air raid precaution at all. And to be fair, we hadn't seen much. Those yacht Stoker came over, very, very few. Most of the traffic we're seeing now, air traffic, was going our way. There was Mitchells and Bostons and Swordfish, you know, all sorts of planes, but all ours. We didn't see many enemy planes at all. And as I say, the precautions had gone. And the troops came into the side of the road. And then eventually the transport company came along, and they pulled up beside us, and they were embossed in minutes, and the traffic just moved on again. It was amazing. There was hardly a break in the traffic of the road. I'd have to pull off the road at this stage. Naturally, with driving a vehicle, I'd been on the road, because the road, especially on the seaside, was very soft. Real sand dunes, very soft. The other side was still soft, but you could, if you'd gone about 200 yards further south of the road, you could have travelled. But I was travelling on the road and sort of pulling off as much as I could to keep up, you know, keeping with the troops and hanging around, really.
What were the signs of battle that you were moving through at this stage?
Well, we were seeing the minefields and how extensive the German minefields were. The Dunnet wire, bodies laid on Dunnet wire, holes where the shells had fallen. I mean, quite a lot of the 8th Army barrage had landed in that area, round the road, because that was the place where the attack was. Well, the attack was just nicely south of the road, maybe 4 miles south of the road. So there was a lot of potholes and tanks, guns, big guns. I think there were two spiked. A spiked gun is where the driver shell in either end and pull the charge, and then it explodes and the gun barrel splays out just like a tulip does. There was a few spiked. Not a lot, mainly, quite a lot of them were burned out.
Was there any booby traps?
At this stage, there wasn't a lot. When we got to Darbo, we rather expected a few, but I don't recall that there was a lot in Darbo either. I think it came on after we got out of the German forward area. When we got back into the Benghazi Tripoli area, then it got very, very bad. But I don't think it was too bad, not just in the German forward troop area, or what had been the German forward troop area. It wasn't too bad, because they'd left pretty sharp, I think, and they hadn't really had time to leave very much. I don't recall much trouble just then. There was some down in the south. There was, I think, one lad lost a hand. This was after we'd been to Darwin, and then we'd gone back again to the south, and we started cleaning up down the south.
Were you seeing any prisoners? Were they?
Oh, swarms of them.
What did they look like? What condition were they in?
Well, worse than we were after we left Alamein, let's put it that way. Funny thing was, that I don't know whether the lads bringing them in to arrange this, but you'd find a few Germans in the front. Very often with their hands behind their heads, still marching pretty smartly, really, but dejected. And then, of course, there was these streams of Italians after that. It appears that the Germans accommodated anything that would move and left the Italians sitting in the trenches, so that there's no way the Italians were going to get anywhere except into the British lines.
Was there much passing of remarks as they went through you and past you?
No, not that I can recall. I think we were all elated that this was happening. We were really quite happy. We're still tired. I mean, we'd had a sleep, but we're still tired. For these lads that had done the advance on the 2nd of November, and here we are somewhere about the 6th of November, and we hadn't really had much sleep in that time, because the battle hadn't finished till the following morning. For all we'd gone to the... what do they call the point where you're going to? You advance to a target. For all we'd done that, what we were expected to, and cleared the minefield and made the gap, by the time the armour was ready to come up, the Germans had whipped their mobile guns in, so where our gap finished, there was now a line of 88s. So the armour didn't get out on the 2nd of November, as we'd expected. And in fact, a brigade of the 51st Division had to go in and just shift a few more 88s the following night. And then, of course, the army got out, and after that it was... But I have a feeling that Rommel had already started to pull back. After the 2nd of November, I think he'd realised that was the end, and he started to pull back. Because there was tales coming through from prisoners that... the Germans had left the Italians in the line, for all these 88s were Germans, but he'd left somebody to stiffen the Italians up. But basically, the Germans, I think, had started to move on the 2nd of November, after the 2nd of November, on the 3rd of November.
So you started the day mopping up, and before the day was out, you were in trucks and moving up to...
And moving up the coast road to Derby. And we camped just south of the road. We could have been north, but I think we were just south of the road, because we're in fairly good desert land at that time. And the company formed up in a defensive box, as you might say, the old style of box, with the anti-tank on the corners. And we didn't have any artillery with us. The artillery was already on the move. And we formed up... with the carriers on the outside, sort of thing, and the anti-tank. And we got down for the night there. There was a few patrols went out round about just to make sure that the perimeter of the box, more or less, was safe. And I think the other two battalions were doing the same thing in another part of the district. I suppose one of them would go to Fulker, which wasn't too far from Derby.
Who were you guarding the dump against?
It's a good question. A very good question. I suppose, really, that it was to prevent too many people stopping off the advance forward and dropping into the dump and helping themselves. We had a fairly good time. I was sent down there to get one or two vehicles, which the battalion was... going to take as a prize, and in fact I believe that's where Kirby got his car. Major Kirby got his what was it, Noble? Can't remember now. But we got a few vehicles from there, And personally, I got myself 28 Beretta revolvers and enough ammunition to last us for years. The Beretta was a nice revolver, just about the size of your hand, and it had a barrel of 10 cartridge, 10 in a clip, and a repeater. A beautiful revolver, it had about 26 of those. And I also got two ladies' revolvers, which were, only about 4 inches long, with ivory handles. And I got some ammunition for those as well. Frankie Hanley, who was the MT corporal who was with me, he won a beautiful accordion and a guitar. He was a man from the dance band. A lot of the lads, they got in among the officers' kit, taking the silk underwear mainly, because silk's good for the desert. There was all sorts. And we weren't down there, that would be the 7th, I think, the next day. We got in at night and formed our box and stayed there the night. And on the 7th, we went down and sort of, I suppose the companies were arranging how they were going to guard this. It was a massive dump, right on the seaside, in the sand dunes. There was plenty of vino, some food that we hadn't sort of seen for dump these years, tins of food. All the officers' mess equipment. Anything to think of that would be in a division headquarters. It was really good. And we got back at night about dusk into the box, where we wanted to stay. I think we moved slightly. We'd moved the box and more towards the camp at that time. And we're planning what we're going to pick up the next day. We had a good drink, and Frankie was playing the accordion. We had a real entertaining night after dark. And eventually got to bed, because we were still tired. But 3 o'clock in the morning, just when the desert's nice and cold, we're in November, and the desert is quite cold, frosty in fact, during the night. And 3 o'clock I had to get up and strip off and have a bath in cold water. I was scratching like mad and I was full of fleas out of the officers' mess camp. So the officers hadn't a very good name from me after that for a while. They go, it was cold, I still feel that water now. It's a funny thing this, you see. You've got the heat of the day and the body, I suppose, is still hot, really, trying to keep the body temperature down. And then you step outside into the frost and the cold. We didn't step outside, we were outside, but we were out of bed. And in the cold, and then cold water as well. It was just a bit chilly. In the morning, I squirreled my gear off, and of course, they were soon dry, and I got shot the fleas. I steeped my gear all night that I'd taken off. I steeped it, squirreled it out the next morning, and got shot the fleas. And so, that morning, instead of going for some more pilfering as we intended to, we went back to Garsel Station. That was sort of the station between Eldava and Telaliza. So we went back some, I suppose, about 10 miles. Why, I don't know, because the following day we moved up to Darba again and continued our guard duties that night. And that was when we heard that Percy was leaving, and Brigadier Beak came along to take over. And the day following that, that was about the 12th, now we did another 24 hours guard there, and we moved after Garsel again. And on the 13th, we moved back through the German lines, down the German lines, and across the Munster Basin, in front of where we'd been, through our lines at Alamein, and we formed up in a position just south of there, almost on the depression, east of the Gazala line and almost on the depression. We spent a bit of time there doing recovering spoils of war, you might say, and there was masses of stuff. Loads of personal weapons, rifles, submachine guns, cookhouse equipment, ambulance equipment, all those masses of stuff, and it was all collected and heaped into its various selections, you might say, ready to go away. The small mountain guns, mountain artillery pieces, the bigger artillery pieces, quite a few bits of track vehicles, the half tracks and tracks, and that was really what my purpose was, to go out and get the vehicles back into a position where they could be collected. I suppose really though, thinking about the Bedouins coming down and maybe getting blowing ourselves up with this stuff. I mean, when you think about it, there was minefields all over the place. There was must have been shells that hadn't exploded. There was ammunition of all descriptions. I mean, especially Bedouin Kins had gone in among this, they could have really got themselves into trouble. So I don't know, but that's probably one reason for trying to get it collected as quickly as possible. We're doing this for quite a while. And then we got back into 50 Div. We hadn't been for some time, because I think we'd been in every division of the 8th Army before now. And we're heavily reinforced by people from quite a few people out of England, straight from England, and some from the depots, Palestine and the Canal Zone. We hadn't lost a lot of people in Alamein, but when you think of the sickness and secondments to other jobs and a little bit of wastage here and there, it did amount to quite a lot. We were sadly depleted. We're still a company short. I mean, we'd only had three companies for some considerable time. So we had got very well down. And it was almost like starting again. We started training. It was almost like starting again with... they'd all done the basic training, but it was like starting company training again. You know, even section training. So people got to know each other. Platoon training, company training, and then brigade under brigade training. So it was almost like starting it as we did in the Cotswolds again. We'd done our basic training at Barnard Castle and Whitburn, and then we had the Cotswolds where we started. So it was almost back to that.
Was your training geared to desert warfare?
Oh yes, yes. It was all desert warfare, and quite a bit of it was done in the depression, the soft sands of the depression.
What was the basic infantry movement in desert warfare? Was it in a line moving forward?
You could never tell.
Did you make use of
you could never
or?
Tell. Mainly, it was arrowhead formation. In a battalion attack, it would be line abreast. If it was a platoon, a patrol going out, they would go in arrowhead formation to the distance they could see each other. Normally about 5 yards apart, but if the night was dark and the sun was blowing strong, they'd be almost touching each other. But you try to do it in arrowhead formation to keep the casualties down as far as possible. Some places, if you were sort of groping your way around a minefield, obviously you would be in line astern. And then you sort of tried tapping, well, not exactly tapping, but you would feel the way with the bayonet on the minefield and work your way around the wire as far as possible.
So this training was basically to take in your new draft and to get you into shape.
It was to get to know each other, basically. I mean, that is what a lot of training is about, and I did explain this about Colonel Battlescombe's attack, that it was a lot of strangers. It's like getting a strange car, and the same thing happens when you've got a lot of every intake, when you get a big intake. I mean, if you get a few, say you get a dozen in a battalion, well, that dozen's got to find its way. But when you get maybe 200... in a battalion, you can't just let them find the way. They've got to be trained, and they've got to get to know their counterparts. I mean, if you've got an anti-tank gun with a crew of five, the number one's got to know that number five is bringing his ammunition up. And the same with the machine gun. The number one on the gun, he wants to know that there's a man behind him bringing ammunition again. Number two is feeding it into the gun. So you've got to be able to know and rely on these people.
Was there a sense of frustration that you weren't in on the advance after fighting so hard to bring it about?
It was a kind of frustration. I wouldn't say disappointment, because nobody's looking for a battle. But there was a feeling that we'd been left out. That we'd fought this battle from Gazala back and then out again, and then we'd been left behind. Yes, we felt that we thought we'd earned enough to be do the rest. But on the other side of the coin, there was a feeling that, yes, well, we had a good battle, and we're not keen to do any more just at the moment. But it's a funny thing about a soldier. There's this thing, you see, that it's the honour of the regiment, isn't it? We've been left out when we should really have been in business. Mm.